Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and legendary radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Be Nice to Your Children show. Comedian Stephen Wright said, be nice to your children. After all, they are going to choose your nursing home. We're going to talk about nursing homes, talk about Alzheimer's dementia, some of the things that happen to us as we get older. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio and a special radio wave to the MSU Ronald G. Eglin Space Science Center. With me from the University of Kentucky to talk about aging...
Thanks for that.
Assistant professor with the Physician Assistant Program, Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
Rick Phillips is away. I would just say Rick Phillips is away.
Getting older by the minute.
All you really need to know. Our sponsor for today's show, Preventable Causes of Cancer Death. And I will say this in quotes because this is what the author of this article said. Primary prevention is the future of cancer care. Now, we're talking about the behaviors that result in almost 50% of all cancer deaths. This was a study originally published by researchers at the American Cancer Society and published back in 2017. We thought it would be nice to remind our radio fans of these behaviors that cause about 50% of cancers. First of all, alcohol consumption. And there is no lower threshold for alcohol consumption. I'm sorry, if I made the rules, there would be. I did not make the rules. There is not. That is, if you drink socially, right? Social drinking. If you drink two beverages a day per men and one beverage a day for women, or if you only drink on weekends, or if you only drink when your fraternity gets together, whatever you do, when you drink alcohol, you raise your risk of cancer. And there are a number of cancers that have been related to alcohol consumption.
And alcohol is alcohol, right? So right. The red wine really isn't any better than...
You know, we almost endorsed red wine as possibly a prevention for heart disease. The data on that were sketchy at the best because people who drink red wine tend to be upper socioeconomic, upper educational, and there were a lot of other things that might have caused us to think that red wine lowered your rate of heart disease. It had some effects on your good cholesterol level, but really not enough to recommend it. So we toyed with the idea, physicians, the medical community toyed with the idea of perhaps recommending red wine consumption. The cancer people weighed in a little late and said, that's really a bad idea. And so we cannot, for your health, recommend that you consume alcohol. The second one is a huge one. The number one linked with all types of cancer is, of course, cigarette smoking. And it appears at the time we are recording, our legislature is still in session. There is still time to do the right thing, but it does not appear that they're going to do that. That is, we have bills to raise the minimum age for smoking up to 21 to try to prevent these cigarette companies from preying on our children. That does not look like it will pass. There is also legislation to make our school system smoke-free. That does not appear to be likely to pass, although we'll give you a status update on that one. And, of course, the idea of an indoor smoking ban where just by living in Kentucky, you don't have to smoke other people's cigarettes every time you go indoors, that appears to be a non-starter.
Which is ridiculous.
Right. We're talking about a disaster in this state. We're talking about over 7,000 deaths a year we can trace directly back to cigarettes, and we're talking about a level of inactivity that is, for me personally, embarrassing. The other one, and I hesitate to put this even on the same show as cigarette smoking, consumption of red and processed meat. Now, these do raise your risk of certain cancers, particularly colon cancer. Processed meat in particular, if you have a square piece of meat, if you have a dinosaur-shaped piece of meat or a piece of meat that is cylindrical or circular. Yes, a star-shaped piece of meat. Those are always processed meats, and the processing adds some ingredients that can increase your risk of certain types of cancer. Excess body weight, yes, it is true. In addition to raising your cholesterol, raising your risk of diabetes and heart disease, excess body weight is associated with certain cancers, particularly breast cancer, endometrial cancer in women are two that are very heavily dependent upon a person, heavily dependent, sorry about that, on a person's weight. And then we'll stop at this one, low consumption of fruits, vegetables, dietary fiber, and calcium. That is if you are a meat person, if you are a person who does not get a lot of fruits and vegetables, you are unnecessarily raising your risk of cancer. That is our sponsor, Preventable Causes of Cancer Death. Primary prevention is the future. We have to get better at this. We can't simply rely on our scans and our surgeons and our robotic interventions to tell us basically how to do this. First up, speaking of that, the unhealthiest vegetables. I saw this and I thought, well, you know, this is worth saying because people think, well, you know, I need more fruits and vegetables, and they don't really think about the types of fruit and vegetables. And there was a singular reason that I found out something about bananas I didn't know. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to bring this on. All right.
Okay.
So the not so healthy fruits and vegetables, here are several fruits and vegetables you might want to consider eating less of, although any fruit or vegetable is better than a microwave burrito.
Agreed.
Can we just say that up here up front? Yes. But these first ones, bananas. Bananas, the perfect food, according to some. Rich in fiber, low in fat and protein, only 105 calories per banana. So, I mean, and the other thing is it's hard to eat five or six bananas. Bananas are good to a point.
They're pretty
I think
heavy.
The reason they stopped at bananas rather than bananas is because, I mean, you get tired of them, whether you're saying them or eating them. Mm-hmm. Bananas are, that's enough. Bananas are just simply enough. 90% of the calories come from carbohydrates. As a matter of fact, if you were to get a low sugar value, you were a diabetic and your sugar started to drop, we would eat a banana to bring it up. They do have a pretty significant amount of sugar in them. Unripe green bananas contain the same amount of carbs. They're in the form of something called a resistant starch, which is not sugar. Resistant starch helps actually to lower the blood sugar and reduce the appetite. As they ripen from green to yellow, the starches convert to sugar. A green banana on a glycemic index, a low 30. Ripe yellow banana, around 50 to 60.
So we should eat green bananas.
Yeah. A can of Coca-Cola has a glycemic index value of 68. A ripe banana has in the 50s. Whereas a green banana. So I was thinking about that. Well, of course, because green bananas are really not that tasty.
True.
I mean, you get that yellow one with the freckles. That's where I want it to be. Consider unripe or less ripe bananas if you're watching your sugar intake. So if you have a choice between a more ripe and a less ripe banana, the less ripe banana has a little bit less sugar in it. Okay, mm-hmm. Next up on the not-so-great fruits and vegetables, corn.
I can see that. It's awful sweet.
Now, Jean Jones, the dietitian, when she was on the show, she said corn is not a vegetable. It is a grain. Well, according to John Murphy, who is a writer for the MD Lynx, corn is a vegetable, a grain, and a fruit. It has characteristics of all three. It has a glycemic index score of around 48, so it's not there with a ripe banana. It's more than the unripe banana. Researchers at the Harvard School of Public Health found that people who regularly ate vegetables with a higher glycemic load, such as corn, tended to gain weight compared with people who ate lower glycemic vegetables, such as broccoli or Brussels sprouts. Is that a surprise to you?
No.
I'm supportive of research. Research tells us things that we need to know. I'm not supportive of that research. It's nice dietary fiber, vitamin C, and it's some good antioxidants, but
more sugar.
The next vegetable, and this breaks my heart, but watermelons.
I don't like watermelon.
Really?
I don't like watermelon.
Oh, man. Brian, our producer, is going apoplectic on the other side of the board here that she doesn't like watermelon. I will tell you, I, as a boy, you know, when we planted a garden, we would plant, you know, like three beans, and then we would have basically a half acre of watermelons. Because what's better than watermelons? Well, lots of things are healthier than watermelon. Granted, 92% of it's water, but it also has a glycemic index of 72. And I still remember we had a group of old ladies were in a mini home. This is a person who takes people in their home and cares for them. And they brought some watermelons into the mini home. And I happened to be taking care of most of these ladies in the mini home. And there were about three or four of them with diabetes. And they came in and just completely out of control because they were chowing down on watermelons. Because it's a vegetable, right? The glycemic index, again, of 72, the glycemic load takes into account the amount of carbohydrates in a serving of food. So even though it has a high glycemic index, not so many carbohydrates, it's not as bad, essentially, as bread, for instance. So if you're going to have – all right, so if you want to make a sandwich with a watermelon.
No, thank you. Nope.
That would be probably better than a sandwich with bread. Okay. So And the other thing is, you know, for whatever reason, we don't use that to raise your sugar in the hospital when it goes low. I think mainly because we can't get it sliced fast enough. But there it is.
Well, and it's somewhat seasonal.
Now, here's one that just kind of catches you by surprise. Mangoes. Loaded with 30 grams of carbohydrates, 26 grams of sugar, 60 on the glycemic index. Oh, yeah. Lots of vitamins, minerals, antioxidants. One mango supplies an entire daily requirement of vitamin C, high in vitamin A, folate, potassium. But you're going to get a heavy carbohydrate load with mangoes. And so, you know, and again, it tastes sweet. That's the thing. If it tastes sweet and it's not a strawberry, then
it's probably.
Yeah, it's going to be trouble. And then finally, potatoes. A baked potato with a skin, 159 calories, 36 grams of carbohydrates, 4 grams of fiber on average, loaded with potassium, magnesium. But the way the potato is grown, the type of potato, all that can change its glycemic index. Medium baked potato, glycemic index of 85. And I've seen some monsters, you know, the ones you get at the steak places.
Yeah.
I don't know, 85 would be conservative for that. Boiled potato, 50. They're not in all bad. Actually, cold cooked potatoes have a lower glycemic index than hot cooked potatoes. I did not know that. This is what John Murphy at MD Link says. He says starch breaks down when potatoes are cooked, resets when they are cold. And so that resistant starch, the thing you're looking for, it's not quite as bad as the other, is better in cold potatoes. On the other hand, if you're going to go to cold potatoes, you're probably going to potato salad. If you go to potato salad, you've got to worry about
other problems.
Yeah. And this is the thing that we try to avoid, like the plague, literally, at our church buffets and family get-togethers and so forth, is potato salad, because a lot of things can go wrong in the preparation of potato salad. Mm-hmm. So,
well, and speaking of potatoes, can we just clarify that ketchup is not a vegetable? So, you know, French fries and ketchup is not a suitable vegetable for your children.
Yeah, you know, and ketchup tastes so good, and it's so much different from tomatoes. I think they should not call it tomato ketchup.
Oh, well, that's, what do you propose?
I don't know. I mean, tomato paste is made out of tomatoes, and it tastes really pretty good. And tomato paste is a healthy thing. Tomato ketchup is not. I guess you take the tomatoes and you throw in some other stuff and sugar. I don't know how you make ketchup.
Lots of sugar.
Yeah, lots of sugar. And so it should be, you know, I don't know. I guess grape Kool-Aid should not be called grape Kool-Aid.
Yeah, that's true.
So there are a lot of things like that, as I think about it, that have been so far removed from nature that they should not be able to harken back to nature. So you could have tomato-flavored condiments.
Uh-huh. And if it's neon colored, that's not a fruit either. That's not a naturally occurring fruit.
Fruits tend not to roll up.
This is true.
Mm-hmm. We're going to roll up and take a break, though. We're going to come back with our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of health care professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Welcome back to the second fractional portion. This is Health Matters, and I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Be Nice to Your Children show, because we, now that we've dispatched with the fruit and vegetable section of the show, we're ready to get to the meat of our program, which is about dementia, about nursing homes, and about what happens to many of us as we get older. The quote comes from comedian Stephen Wright. He says, "Be nice to your children. After all, they are going to choose your nursing home." Our sponsor for the second time, the preventable causes of cancer death. Primary prevention is the future. We talked in our first fractional portion that 50% of cancers are potentially preventable or at least modifiable. And we talked about alcohol consumption, cigarette smoking, a consumption of red and processed meat, excess body weight, and low consumption of fruits, vegetables, dietary fiber, and calcium. And I suppose even if you ate your watermelon and mangoes, you would have a lower rate of cancer, even though you may gain some weight because they have a lot of sugar in them. Next up, physical activity. Physical activity very clearly linked to lower rates of cancer, as well as to improve cardiovascular outcomes. So for goodness sakes, if there is one thing, if you are in your 60s, your 70s, if you are thinking about how to prepare for your old age, if you want to change the trajectory that you are on. Well, at any age, physical activity is a great place to start. It's simply a matter of putting in the time. It may be hard to resist all the food that is around you. It may be hard to make real long-term progress on weight loss. But my goodness, you can certainly set aside a certain amount of time a day and do something. Secondhand smoke, also with the firsthand smoke, if we try to avoid that, such as passing a indoor smoking ban statewide. Unfortunately, we are left to our own defenses on that. We try to frequent places that don't allow smoking indoors. Just the other day, I was doing a house call, and the house was absolutely full. There were three or four chain smokers, and I couldn't do it. I've gotten to the point where I cannot tolerate that anymore.
It can be very hard to breathe. And the idea of not making our schools totally smoke-free, that's ridiculous to me.
Yeah. And then finally, ultraviolet radiation. Oddly enough, ultraviolet radiation causes more cancer in men than in women. And you would, frankly, if the concern is tanning beds, I believe that women outnumber men in tanning beds by a substantial margin. And certainly tanning beds are not a healthy behavior. On the other hand, ultraviolet radiation seems to be more of a factor in men than women, perhaps because men spend more time outdoors.
And less time putting on sunscreen.
Maybe. Well, that's certainly true. That is so. The cigarette smoking, as we mentioned, made up the greatest share of the cancer cases and deaths. 19% of cases, 28% of cancer deaths that could have been prevented. Second leading lifestyle factor was excess body weight, 7.8% of cases, 6.5% of deaths. Alcohol intake, 5.6% of cases, 4% of deaths. Of course, the thing that is frustrating to us in Eastern Kentucky, lung cancer has the highest number of cases and deaths potentially attributable to preventable factors. On the one hand, this has been used by some people to argue we shouldn't screen for lung cancer because what we ought to do is focus on prevention, which would be a wonderful thing if we could do both. I don't see right now a focus on prevention of lung cancer. I don't see any population measures that are easily doable. That's the frustrating thing. That is the thing that makes me go on these long radio rants is this is the number one cause of cancer death in Kentucky and in the United States. We lose 3,500 Kentuckians every year to lung cancer. That is more than twice the number of people we lose to narcotics, and yet we have a complete lack of activity to try to lower our rate of this preventable cause of death. I'll stop there.
I mean, what else can you say?
That's our sponsor, Preventable Causes of Cancer Death. Primary prevention is the future, except in Kentucky. This was back in September of last year. Tim Newman published it on Medscape. And I thought it was time to bring it out because I'm puzzling as to how this is going to impact my practice. First of all, we know that the season of the year affects your health. Certainly, the flu comes in winter and so forth. But there's something called seasonal affective disorder that it appears that the long winter nights and the short winter days, it does for many people, it can cause them to become more depressed. And we have also found that bright light therapy sometimes can make a difference for that. Schizophrenia most likely to occur in winter. Some studies have also demonstrated a variation in memory and attention performance. Researchers from Sunnybrook Health Sciences and the University of Toronto looked at Alzheimer's disease, and they found that it could fluctuate across the year. There was a longitudinal study, 3,300 older adults in the United States, Canada, and France. Some had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, others had not. And they had these batteries of tests, 19 cognitive tests that they looked at, and also tested for a level of protein, which is that's the beta amyloid protein linked to Alzheimer's. Their average cognitive functioning was better during the summer and fall than during the winter and spring. So we're right in the middle right now of the low cognitive functioning period. The difference is just staggering, was calculated to be the equivalent of 4.8 years of normal cognitive decline. Your brain is 5 years younger in the summer than it is in the winter.
Wow, that's pretty astounding.
It really is. Now, think about that for a minute. You think about, is there a medication out there? And I can already tell you the answer.
Nope.
Yeah. That could give you back 5 years of mental functioning. Absolutely not. And yet summer can. Maybe you vacation near the equator. Maybe you know that's the purpose of Florida. Maybe the whole thing is not you're tired of the cold. Maybe it's you recognize that you can think if you can find a warm place. I don't know if it's the warmth. I don't know if it's the sunshine. You know, that's the thing we don't know. But it appears that there is a substantial variation. And
did they test that with light therapy?
No. No, this was, you know, again, this was what they did was they across several years, the colder months, participants 31% more likely to fall into the range for Alzheimer's disease diagnosis. The Alzheimer-related proteins that I mentioned, they did also fluctuate across the seasons. There may be value in increasing dementia-related clinical resources in the winter, is what they thought. Gee, we're going to have to gear up for this onset of Alzheimer's disease. Colder months worsen symptoms of dementia and reduce cognitive ability in adults at large. Several things. You know, first of all, it makes me wonder then if there's that much variation from season to season. As we talked about, the drugs don't do that much, so how can we trust really our drug studies? If someone started a drug study in the winter.
True.
And carried it through to the summer, they're going to see fantastic improvements in cognitive function. Now, I have talked to some people as far as nursing homes and people who are involved with Alzheimer treatment, and they confirmed this was their suspicion. Yes, we do get more referrals in the winter, and so maybe we ought to have more resources available. My question is, is there a noticeable improvement then? I'll give it specifically. Can I expect my mother to get better in the spring? My mother has Alzheimer's disease. She is older now. And could I expect her to improve in the spring? Well, not so much. You and I have taken care of patients. It's not like they suddenly are cured.
Right.
I mean, 5 years ago, she was much better off than she is now. But I don't really expect her to start driving again or anything like that. I'm not ready to look for that.
Well, and it's interesting, too, whether it's the warmth or the light or what exactly it is, because we've taking care of patients who they've been stuck inside, you know, they're homebound or they may be bedbound, and they don't necessarily see the sunlight or the fresh air or feel the warm air from outside. So what is it, and which patients would it make a difference in?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, one of the things, there's a couple of take homes here while we're trying to sort all this out. One is that if you have an elderly relative, you need to be particularly alert to those symptoms in November, December, as we start to head into winter. You may notice a significant deterioration. And there's something they call sundowning, which for people with Alzheimer's disease and other problems that affect their cognitive abilities, that in the evening hours or in the nighttime, things get sometimes very noticeably worse, and they are much more put together during the day. Obviously, longer nights would have to do with that. So just be prepared. If it's probably not random, if you have an elderly relative or friend living alone, it is probably not random that things may go worse in the months of November and December. Now, I suppose if they make it through the winter, you can say, well, you know, we can probably go the summer. We're probably going to see some extra stability. Now, this is in general. They had over 3,000 people that they were studying. You cannot bet the farm on this. You cannot take this to the bank for an individual person. Circumstances, things happen that alter the course of Alzheimer's disease that we don't yet understand. And I don't want us to become so mysterious about it that because we don't understand it. But by the same token, you hope now that as we get past the darkest part of winter, as we start into spring here in March, maybe we might be able to see some stability in our elderly and loved ones and relatives.
Yeah, and you know, a little extra sunshine and fresh air never hurt anybody, I don't suppose.
Yep. Next up, I want to get to the very heart during this fractional portion. And this is what really suggested this show. March 4th, this was the New York Times. The writer was Jack Healy, a person I'm not familiar with, but did a nice job. The standard way that you put these things in the paper is you give a case. You make this thing personal. So he talked about Harold LeBrenz, 89-year-old farmer, basically of Mobridge, South Dakota. Their economy worsened. There were several businesses left town. LeBrenz was in the nursing home, and the nursing home closed. Basically, the closest nursing home that could take care of him was 220 miles away. 90 years old, headed across country. His wife, 76. They found she had family living close by, so she wasn't entirely left without being able to visit him. Obviously, 220 miles away, she's not going to get there very often, but she was able to move up there. But about 3 days after he got to the new nursing home, he died. You know, at age 90, you change the situation, and things can fall apart pretty quickly.
That's a hard trip.
Yeah, and then they talk about the statistics, and this is what I wanted to talk about. The COWS Research Group tracks long-term care and mentions that more than 440 rural nursing homes have closed or merged over the last 10 years. 440 over the last 10 years, about 44 nationwide rural nursing homes a year are closing. And so they mentioned 5 nursing homes closed in Nebraska last year, 6 shut down in Maine, which is the highest total in a single year that Maine has had. 36 across the country forced to close down because they failed to meet health and safety standards. More about that later. Most of them collapsed due to financial reasons. A lot of times Medicaid has plays a very big role. Medicaid, we call it the payer of last resort. After you have exhausted your funds, after you have spent all your money as a senior citizen, you have spent everything you have on your health care or whatever you spend it on, and you need to be in a nursing home, the state picks up the tab with Medicaid. They don't pay well. In many cases, they don't pay enough to pay the bills that the nursing home incurs, but they pick up your care after you've done that. They also mentioned in the New York Times 5 South Dakota nursing homes have shut down in the past 3 years. Dozens more are losing money because of South Dakota's their low Medicaid reimbursement rates. Well, you know, for our radio fans in Kentucky, I'm sure you're asking by this point, why are we talking about South Dakota? Because let's face it, we in Kentucky are not in a great position on this. I'll move a little bit closer to home. This was the Lexington Herald Leader. And I've got about 10 facts that I want to talk about from the Lexington Herald Leader, September 27th of last year. And by the way, the Louisville Courier-Journal did some work on this in Lexington paper as well, looking at Kentucky's nursing home. I got the Lexington version of this. 43% of Kentucky's 284 nursing homes were rated as below average or much below average. Now, on the surface, you would say 43% of Kentucky's nursing homes are below average. Now, mathematically, I'm perfectly fine with that.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense from just a numbers point of view. It makes sense.
Yeah. There's really not much way around it that close to 50% of them are going to be below average,
right?
If it's done properly. But the level they're below average is where the Lexington Herald, so even though they may not be great with math, they do have some points here. That's among the worst collective ratings for nursing homes in the country. So average is not really average nationally. Kentucky's facilities received 6 times as many immediate jeopardy deficiencies from inspectors as the national average. Fines were 6 times larger than the national average. So that's not good.
And isn't going to help the financial situation. I mean, you can see how they would just dig a hole and it would keep getting bigger and bigger.
Federal government recommends an expected staffing level of nursing homes allow a resident every day to get more than 1 hour of care from nurses, 2 hours and 45 minutes of care from nurses' aides.
Not happening.
Oh, I can tell you. I mean, and if you think about it, 1 hour of care from registered nurses and 2 hours and 45, there are hospitals that have trouble meeting that. Acute care hospitals have that.
Right.
The Kentucky nursing homes, 43 minutes of daily care from registered nurses, 2 hours, 19 minutes from nurses' aid. And again, we were looking for an hour and then 2 hours and 45 minutes. I've got fun facts here. Fun fact number 4. Rick Nelson, Middlesbrough, introduced a bill in Kentucky that insists on minimum requirements for staffing the state's nursing homes. Ran into a brick wall. It was House Bill 573. Rule would have required one nurse on duty for every 21 residents during the day, every 29 at night, one nurse's aide for every 9 to 10 residents during the day, and 19 residents at night. Larger facilities, additional nursing supervisors on staff. Nurses assigned to administrative jobs would not have counted toward the minimum ratio. If you fail to meet those ratios, $1,000 a day. And it went nowhere. Now, the nursing home lobby is pretty powerful. They have, if you are of that sort, that the large nursing home companies, and there are large companies operating these nursing homes, they have a great amount of legislative influence. On the other hand, I've got to tell you, you know, just simply trying to make this work on Kentucky's Medicaid reimbursement would be, I think, difficult.
Yeah, I think so too. And if you think about just the infrastructure, some of these buildings were built decades ago. They weren't designed for a lot of the modern innovation and thing that we know now will help, especially with some of our dementia patients. You know, how are you going to increase sunlight and sun lamps and activities that we know are going to help them do better mentally and function better if they don't even have the space to do that. They're overcrowded, underfunded, and the holes just get bigger and bigger every year with the fines.
Now, on the other side of the legislative argument is Senator Ralph Alvarado, who's from Winchester. He says setting a mandatory staffing ratio is unrealistic. Too many facilities would fail. This is Alvarado, I'm quoting him. We struggle to find people willing to work in nursing homes. It can be a tough job. You're helping people who might have dementia. They can curse at you. They can hit. They can pinch. And frankly, that's true of nursing just about anywhere within our healthcare system, particularly in our emergency rooms. Mm-hmm. Now, he is a doctor in private life who works as a medical director at 5 low-rated nursing homes around Central Kentucky. So he is not without a personal interest in this, which the Lexington Herald leader points out. On the other hand, you know, as a physician, I can tell you it would be very hard to meet these staffing. Now, is that an excuse? You know,
it's not an excuse, but it is a reason to get more funding.
Yeah, I think we have to. I think that's the thing. We as a state, we have to decide: are we willing to put the money into this or not? If we're willing to put the money into it, we're fine. Now, these are big companies; they are profitable companies. But again, you look across the nation. If you pull the money out, like South Dakota did, that's why we started with them. Then the nursing home closed. Nebraska pulled the money out; the nursing homes closed. So you've got really one of two options there. You either pay more money than you think that you should, or they close, or the Kentucky option is don't pay them any money but keep them open. We're going to close down for a break, and we're going to come back with our last 5 points about nursing homes in our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello, and welcome back to the third and final fractional portion. I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Health Matters Be Nice to Your Children show. This is from comedian Stephen Wright, who said, be nice to your children. After all, they are going to choose your nursing home. And we are talking about aging, we're talking about dementia, and we're talking about some facts on nursing homes. I mentioned again, we do not have enough money, we do not have enough resources to take care of our senior citizens. And so you can cut back on payments, and you can say, look, you're just going to have to work this out. And many of the nursing homes, they will close, or they will move to more lucrative areas. They will go where the wealth is. As with many issues of healthcare, rural areas are in more danger than urban areas regarding this. The other thing you can do is you can mandate that they take care of people without, again, that mandate, as many, without accompanying funding for it from Medicaid is not likely to produce the results that you want. And it is, again, it is we have to make some decisions here about how much we're going to do. Unfortunately, right now, I mean, in my mind, unfortunately, I don't want to see anyone lacking in care. Our nursing homes are not the best places for senior citizens to get care. They're just not.
They aren't. And we don't even have a support system or a structure that would support people to take care of their loved ones at home. And that is, it's such a difficult job to do. And you can't work, you can't be involved with your own children's lives if you're taking care of a aging family member. And we just don't support individuals like that.
Yeah. While we're talking about the nursing homes, your point is really well taken, Shelley, from my standpoint. If we are going to spend money on taking care of elderly people, and again, we're going to be making a lot of elderly people in the next 10 years, the cheapest way, far and away the cheapest way, is to keep them at home or to keep them with family. And so if we can make that so that it works, so that it's not impossible to do, so that you don't have to be heroic in order to take care of your elderly loved one, that would make a big difference. And it would be money well spent, because if what happens, the reason in most cases a person goes to the nursing home is the family just gets exhausted. Mm-hmm. It is not necessarily they have a new disease that requires a nursing home. It's just that the amount of care that they require gets so extraordinary, the family just gets completely exhausted. And that's the biggest reason, I think, a person goes into a nursing home. So, at any rate, we That's why we are talking about this. Our sponsor for the final time, the preventable causes of cancer death. Primary prevention is the future of cancer care. That quote comes from Elizabeth Platts, who's the deputy chair of epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. It would be better if we had help. We in Kentucky particularly have had a disastrous love affair with cigarettes. Our legislators have in the past protected people's ability to smoke anywhere they want to, including around other non-smokers. We are at the point where that protection is gone, but our legislature has so far not stepped up and done something about lowering our rate of smoking, which still leads the nation. There are things that have been tested in every other state and found to work. Increasing the cigarette tax. And we did that a little bit, but we did not do it at the level we should have. Banning indoor smoking. These are things that are tested and absolutely shown to reduce rates of smoking among population. Probably increasing the age to 21. It makes sense. We've not tested it to see how effective it is, but it makes sense that it would be effective. And then finally, doing something about our schools and making them both cigarette and e-cigarette free. These companies should not be allowed to make a profit by preying on our young people. It is immoral and it is reprehensible that we don't do anything to stop it. That's enough. Alcohol consumption, cigarette smoking, consumption of red and processed meat, excess body weight, low consumption of fruits and vegetables, physical inactivity, secondhand smoke and ultraviolet radiation, all of these things are ways we could prevent cancer. And the final thing, I skipped it, but I'll come back to it, some cancer-related infections, mainly HPV. If we vaccinate against human papillomavirus when our kids are young, they are much less likely to get cervical cancer, and they appear to be less likely to get oral cancers. These are nice things to do, and primary prevention is the future of cancer care.
Now, we usually vaccinate around 11 or 12 years of age for
that's
the
right,
HPV.
Up to age 26, currently for girls and boys. And that has been, for the boys especially, has been a hard sell. It is a way to prevent some really, really nasty cancers that affect people at a relatively young age. Goodness gracious, get vaccinated. It makes sense. HPV vaccine, this is one of the better vaccines we've come out with recently. Back to the nursing home. We were talking last time. We talked about the South Dakota experience where the nursing home closed. People are shipped dispersed. They're scattered like seeds in the wind across other nursing homes in the state, families torn apart, a trail of tears for our senior citizens to go to another nursing home that often ends poorly, I would put it that way. The Kentucky experience, keep them open, but again, many providing care that is
suboptimal.
Suboptimal is a good word, but it incurring fines and also what they called immediate jeopardy. Immediate jeopardy deficiency, six times the national average, is the state of Kentucky. Continuing what we talked about before, and I've just written a set of 10 facts that I got out of the Lexington Herald Leader, John Chief, September 27, 2018, review of this. Kentucky sets tough rules for other places for vulnerable people. The child care centers in Kentucky, for instance, civil penalties if they do not have an adequate staffing level. But nursing homes, again, mostly they're owned by for-profit corporation. They can decide their own staffing. Now, you think about it. I think most child care centers across the state are independently owned. They are not corporate child care centers.
Probably.
Yeah. But the nursing homes, I would say the majority are now corporate. Mm-hmm. And the corporate people do not play by the same rules as the independent ones. Child care center has to do that. Now, one thing about it, the child care, you can set your rates. You basically, whatever it costs to have the staffing and meet the rules, you decide that. You charge that rate, and people can pay it or they can take their kids somewhere else. Nursing homes don't have that option. They have to go somewhere. You can't just take mom out and home nursing home her.
Home nursing home her.
That at least is more difficult. Fun fact number seven, Kentucky might be at the bottom of the scale. It's not unique. Charlene Harrington at the University of California in San Francisco looked at 150 prior studies over 25 years. Higher staffing levels definitely linked to better medical outcomes for residents. And I can say the same thing happens at hospitals. You see the hospitals, they've got robotic laser surgery. They've got the emergency room wait times are published on billboards. They've linked themselves to the Mayo Clinic or any of those things. But the single thing they can do that would make you more likely to come out of that hospital alive and intact is to increase the nursing staffing. It is not glamorous. You can't put that on a billboard. But my goodness, it makes a difference if there's somebody around. Fun fact number eight, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services runs a five-star rating system. 5 stars, much above average. 4 stars, above average. 3 stars, average. 2 stars, below average. And 1 star, much below average. Over the last years, Kentucky's nursing homes collectively ranked among the worst in the country. As of August 7th, 2018, Kentucky had 52 one-star nursing homes. That's 18% of the total. And 71 two-star nursing homes. That's 25% of the total. Now, again, they are below average. If you accept that average is okay, then half of them should be two-star and one-star nursing homes. The problem is that even an average nursing home is not necessarily the optimum way, as you said, to take care of our senior citizens. Over the last 3 years, 48 of the low-rated nursing homes have received at least one citation, the most serious. 29 have accumulated fines greater than $100,000. 18 have been temporarily denied Medicaid payments because of a pattern of unresolved quality problems. Number nine, Kentucky homes rank near bottom for bed sores and also the use of antipsychotic medications. These are medicines that sort of control agitated behaviors. We use more of that than many places. You try to minimize that if you can. If you can control a person's behavior, again, by having the nurses sit with that person, by distracting them or something like that, they are healthier than if you give them pills. And we tend to give more pills. And then finally, one of the larger corporations, nursing home corporation in the state of Kentucky, is Signature Health. And their CEO, Joseph Steyer, said Kentucky is the only state we're in where there's been a Medicaid freeze for 9 years. When you think about it, we usually get a 5% raise every year. Well, I don't, but apparently he does. You can imagine when the pay rate stays the same, it makes people say, I can't work in this state. I don't want to be in this state. Most companies want to run their buildings fully staffed. I don't think anybody, he says, would want to run a building short staffed. The liability is too high. Now, I mean, we can throw rotten mangoes at him, some high glycemic fruit at him. But he's right. I mean, if you freeze for 9 years, you don't change your payments. Either you were overpaying 9 years ago or you're starting to really run short because life does not freeze for 9 years.
And you know regulations have increased and the fines have increased, but if they aren't getting the financial resources to keep up with it, what are they supposed to do?
Yeah, and I want our radio fans to understand, I am not taking I'm not taking the side of the nursing home directors. I believe that the better staffing would pay off. I've experienced enough of my patients in nursing homes to know that that this is not the best situation. I am, as a problem solver, just telling you that you're going to have to spend some money if you're going to solve this problem. We're going to have to commit some funding to this if we're going to solve this problem. And the people that are in the nursing homes are not able to shell out more on their own. It's not like they're saving up for the future. In fact, they are in the nursing home, especially the ones that are covered by Medicaid, because they have already spent everything that they have on their medical care. So, all right, we will move out of the nursing home, but I did want to – I mean, we need something depressing, obviously, every week on this show.
You're good at that, so do you have anything happy?
No, I'm going to
– No? Nothing?
I'm going to keep going. I mean, the fact that it's March and maybe people's Alzheimer's disease is going to get spontaneously better. This was from the AMA Journal, and it made me mad. It was 2019. When was it? January 25th, 2019. And so these things have been building up. I get angry easier now than I used to. And I just go off and just grouse like an old man that I am. This was from Joanna Helmuth, Gil Rabinovich, and Bruce Miller. And they published this in the AMA Journal. And this was about, the title is The Rise of Pseudo-Medicine for Dementia and Brain Health. Now, they mentioned the U.S. population is aging, of course, the increased risk of Alzheimer's disease we all know about. But there is something called pseudomedicine, supplements and medical interventions that exist within the law and are promoted as scientifically supported treatments but lack credible efficacy data.
Prevagen.
Yeah. Supplements of all sorts to improve cognition, dietary supplements to improve cognition and brain health. $3.2 billion with a B dollar industry promoting brain health benefits from high penetration consumer advertising through print media, radio, and so forth. What they're saying is true. No known dietary supplement prevents cognitive decline or dementia. That is fish oil. That is, again, the Prevagen. That is any type of brain food that you get on the internet or you see advertised on TV. There are no dietary supplements. Even though they are widely advertised, anything from ginkgo to others, to try to promote brain health. Supplements can cause harm. Vitamin E, we thought, might help with cognitive ability, but it leads actually to higher rates of bleeding, including bleeding into the brain. And the other thing is that we spend a lot of money on this, and frankly, we miss an opportunity then to do something a little bit which would be of more value. We were wasting our money.
And it bothers me that these companies, whether it's intentional or not, they're preying on people's fear. They're making money off of preying on people's fear. Nobody wants to get dementia.
Yeah. Another section talks about the causes of Alzheimer's. Is it metals, mold exposure, infections, and so forth? And so these people promote things that they to try to prevent the causes. The interventions such as cognitive training and a heart healthy diet, they sometimes repackage those and try to sell those, even though these are things that really should not be that much extra money to a family. This is what they say for clinicians. Understand the motivations come from a desire to obtain the best medical care. Provide honest interpretation of supporting evidence. Appropriately label pseudomedicine interventions as such. Suggests an exploration of financial interest behind the intervention. Find out who's actually promoting this. And point out that any effective interventions for common diseases would already be widely used. That is, you can't suppress something that works. Even if, you know, if you talk about the medicine and the pharmacy people getting together, we couldn't stop something that actually works from getting out. And then it says continue to partner with patients in their medical care, even if they take on pseudomedicine. Now, all that's good. They're absolutely right. I'm fine with this article. We should not be, as you said, promoting these dietary supplements. My problem is this. I don't think that the Alzheimer's drugs work. I'm talking about Aricept. I am talking about Namenda. I don't think these drugs work.
Yep. I'm less than impressed with, you know, what we see clinically.
And this is something that the medical establishment is promoting. Now, these drugs, they just a little bit of background on them. They've been around now for about 7 or 8 years. The research that they presented to the FDA was in 2012. It was a short-term study. It was a year. It was 18 months. They were never looked at for 2 years, 5 years, or 10 years. And people are on them much longer than the research supports. They, during that time, the response rate was 1 in 12. You treat 12 people, one of them gets better. 11 of them don't get better. The one person who gets better, you could measure the improvement using some cognitive tests. Could they work a maze faster? The families in these studies never saw any difference in the behavior of the people that were on the drugs. These are the drugs we're using. These are the drugs we're spending money on. And right now, the horrific thing about it is people are frightened to take them off the medicines, even after they've been on them for 10 years, because, oh my gosh, they would collapse without that drug.
Right.
That drug is not making them any better, but how much worse would they be if they hadn't been taking it for the last 5 years?
Right.
And this, to me, is abhorrent. I'm sorry. I know there are some good doctors out there who prescribe these medicines and use these medicines, and they're doing their best. But I do not like these medicines. I do not like what I see. I see a lot of financial toxicity. I see a lot of misery being caused with them. And I don't see people walking out of the nursing home or resuming driving their car after starting these medicines.
Right. And you don't see any caregiver relief?
No. I know this may generate some arguments. I will just tell you, I don't like these drugs. Convince me that I am wrong. You cannot do it in the scientific literature. There are not scientific studies that prove that there is a measurable behavioral difference from these studies. I don't think so. Very quickly, very briefly, special thanks to Morehead State Public Radio producer Brian Courtney, to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting us on the web. Go to WMKY.org to get a replay of our show. Go to HM Radio Show on Facebook just to talk to us and to email us. Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.